Well, good evening. My name's Scott Anthony. I'm a co-convener of the Public History Seminar. And the thing about the seminar is it's not just about history for the widest public, it's also history by the public. And to that end, we want to make this as a participative session as possible. We've taken some questions in the week on Twitter, on email, and what have you, and I want to put those questions to Peter and Oliver in the 40 minutes or so we have. I also, of course, want to take questions from you, as many questions as possible. I'm going to give you 5 minutes to think up some questions, and then we'll have some roving mics. But whilst you're thinking of those questions, I'm going to sort of abuse the privilege of the chair. I thought it would be really useful, actually.
This is blocking your visual. You have to think about how they can see you. They don't want to see a bottle.
Well,
is that better? The microphones are bad enough. Can you see us? The light's pretty dim, but that's nice. So it feels like we're in a science class for Charles Darwin sort of thing.
As long as we don't blow up the laboratory, that doesn't matter. I suppose it would be really nice just to know a little bit about the genesis of the project, how you met, what you were trying to do, how you came together.
Briefly, are we going to take questions at some point?
Yes, right.
So
yes.
Obviously you can follow up on what you like. Is this fine?
Yes.
To the back? Can you hear? Yeah. No, I met Peter in 1996 at the American University. He teaches history and is the director of the Nuclear Institute of Studies. His specialty has been nuclear war, and which really is a dull subject, it seems, at times. But frankly, I wasn't that interested in it. But he brought me there for a class at American University for History. He was teaching in my films, all the films that were historical. Very popular class, apparently. We went out to dinner, and I asked him idly, about to tell me a little bit about the atomic bomb, because I knew he'd bore me. Because, frankly, in America, we don't follow that subject anymore. It's accepted. It happened. We dropped the bomb to end the war. Japan surrendered based on that bomb, and that was the end of World War II. So it was a very clear American narrative of triumphalism. Peter put a twist into it and said, no, you ever heard of Henry Wallace? And he put this Hitchcockian twist into this great story of the atomic bomb. He made it interesting and personalized it because Wallace was invested in preventing that bomb from being misused. And indeed, like a Frankenstein's monster, it was dropped very quickly and without thought by Truman and his gang in 45. Great story. And how to tell it. It became obsessive. 12 years go by. I want to do something about Wallace. It doesn't quite happen. I come to him after the George Bush interregnum of 8 years, and I'm really depressed. Really depressed. I mean, it seems like, what's the point? What am I going to be here for? I can't make another movie like this. I have to simply try to put it all together into one movie, which is a documentary that would go from 1945 to now, or basically 1940 to now, my era. And I would leave it for my children. And that was the initial impulse. And Peter was the nursemaid. You wanted to explain your own.
Well, I'll start by contradicting Oliver. In 1996, when I told Oliver the story about Henry Wallace and the atomic bomb and the origins of the Cold War, that was right after the Enola Gay controversy in the United States. Oliver says people didn't want to talk about the atomic bomb. It had roiled academia in the United States when the Smithsonian canceled the exhibit, which was because it was challenging the traditional narrative about the atomic bomb. This was a huge issue in the United States and really throughout academia. So there was a lot of interest in the atomic bomb, actually, but the difficulty of presenting the kind of narrative that you saw in our documentary in America's official museums said that the United States was not yet ready to deal seriously and honestly and critically with its own past. And so the American Legion and the Air Force Association intervened, and the Congress threatened to cut off funding to the Smithsonian as the Smithsonian went ahead with that Enola Gay exhibit. Then finally, in 2003, they display the plane at the annex to this Air and Space Museum, the Uvar-Hazy Annex, and General John Jack Daley, the head of the Air and Space Museum, says we're going to display the Enola Gay in all of its glory as a magnificent technological achievement. So if you go there now, you see it being displayed, but in a very, very uncritical, unthinking way, without any of this history, without any of this context. But Oliver and I began this friendship and collaboration back in 1996, and then it blossomed over the years. In 2008, we spent 5 years working on this project. So you saw episode 3. We also have an 800-page book that we wrote as part of this to give a lot of the background, the documents, the evidence, so that people can see why we're saying what we're basing this on, and to give that background.
Thanks. I have two more questions before I'm going to open up to the audience. And firstly, is the obvious question, in a sense that it's a polemical series and a polemical book, and sets itself up as a corrective to correct, you know, biases in the mainstream American media in particular. And I'm just curious to Peter, how your sort of peers in academia have responded, in a sense, because it's something that humanities scholars are perhaps often squeamish about, rightly or wrongly. And to Oliver, in a sense, just to pick up what you said there, in terms of, did you see this, in a sense, as a new project or a new step into a new field? Because it does strike me that so much of your sort of film career is about the untold history of the United States, you know, back to Salvador, in a sense. And, you know, on the one hand, this is a Gonzo History Channel project. On the other hand, it seems a sort of continuing theme of your work.
I like that, Gonzo History. I do. I really like it. We'll get back to that. Go ahead.
What you have to understand the response in academia, is that the United States, among historians, the historical profession moved pretty sharply to the left by the 1970s. A lot of the people who were active in the new left went into academia, and history, the traditional view of history that we saw in the 50s and 60s and 40s, begins to be challenged in the 1970s. And that's when we have the new social history, the influence of E.P. Thompson. You've got history from the bottom up beginning in the 1970s and 1980s. And the kind of that progressive view became really hegemonic among historians in the United States. So the response from historians has been quite positive. There have been some who are the old style Cold War liberals who don't like it, and some who are more conservative don't like it. But the response from my colleagues has been very, very positive. The response from mainstream media has been more critical, because they do not know the world of academia. They don't know the challenge to the traditional narrative. And so what we're doing throughout, we're challenging the idea of American exceptionalism. We're challenging the notion of the American empire as a force for good in the world, unmitigatedly. We're challenging the necessity for a national security state. We began this project in 2008, looking at trying to say to the American public that Iraq and Afghanistan, those two disastrous invasions of that period, were not aberrations, that they were part of this continuum of American history going back to the 1890s, and we wanted to show that, so we lay it out, the recurrent patterns.
To keep it on the personal level, my own involvement with this, I made a movie about Bush called W. It was a lighter portrait of a man, but I think you saw it was quite a bit of malice. It was quite a bit of satire and malice in my portrait of him. However, the justice of what Bush did is a much bigger story, and we had to deal with that in this history. So the idea was to include this ongoing corruption of what I would call the global security state, which was established really by the Pentagon after World War II and grew. Even when our enemies, the Soviet Union, fell off the map, or actually called the Cold War off, we kept going. We never stopped. We kept going into the sands of Saudi Arabia with the invasion of Kuwait. We put the most amount of American troops ever since Vietnam into the Middle East, which was insane, stirring up passions of all kinds in Saudi Arabia, the Mecca. Very clumsy moves, and outwardly, geographically dictated by, I believe, a desire for oil, gas, control. Control is more important than any single wealth, and that is the key to dominate the region, the Middle East. So that led off into this new period with 2001. We never stopped, that's my point. And this military, industrial, financial state has only expanded for the worse. But seeing this for my children is very
can be very, I think the best thing I can do at this point, because I woke up late in my life, I was 40 years old when I actually went back to Central America and saw with my own eyes the behavior in the 1980s of the Reagan people and the troops that we had there and the attitude toward the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and the support we gave to the madness, the dictators and the death squads that were wiping out and oppressing the poor people of these regions. And not even being able to get away with calling it communist, serious communist anymore. So this made me say, and I said to myself, look, I'm a little bit stupid here. I saw this in Vietnam, I was ashamed of it, but I never really saw it so clearly as I threw Redux the second time in Central America. That sent me off onto a commitment to make progressive films, but none of them could match the overall picture that was, I couldn't do it, the overall untold story with a generation of Tolstoyan people. It would be a nice idea, you know, it'd be a great idea to do 1940 to now, but it's quite a big work. But to do it as a documentary seemed feasible. Little did I know it would not take 2 years, it would take five, and it would go over budget, and it would be very difficult. But because I tried to do it with my left hand in the beginning, and I found that it needed my right hand too. So frankly, I learned a lot in the last few years, but I'm just trying to say that I came late to these, I came late in my life. I was a conservative, raised conservative. I fought in Vietnam as a patriot. I believed in what America was doing. I never questioned it. I never even questioned the atomic bomb. And when you start to go there and you start to question that first thing, that founding myth of our republic, the atom bomb, you essentially open up Pandora's box. You'll never go back. All these things that happened will never go back into that box and be easily explained as the end of World War II. And it sets up a vastly alternative history, but you start with the atomic bomb.
Okay. I think probably the best thing is to start taking some questions from the audience. We have two roaming mics. Where are they? Hello. Perhaps we could go to the right side of the room first, and then we'll take three questions together. Please try and keep your questions succinct and to the point so we can get through as many as possible. So if there's any questions over here, please raise your hand. Okay, so do you want to take one, two, three? Yeah.
Hi, I'm taking in tweets for the IHR Public History Seminar. So I have one in from Nick Blackburn, who's a PhD history student at St Andrews University, and he asks a public history question. How do you balance in these kind of popular formats the need to entertain with the complexity of the past?
So the question was, how do you balance the need to entertain and the complexity of the past? Let's take two more questions.
I was wondering if Oliver subscribed to the belief of New World Order and, essentially that to start things off.
Do the panel subscribe to the belief in the New World Order? And coming down to the middle, do you want to take them?
Hi there. I guess I'm interested in what gave you, how you decided on each segment in the series of documentaries. So was it the actual tangible, untold stories themselves, or was it you were interested in a specific sequence of events and you were looking for those untold stories within those events?
Okay, and how did you break the series down into discrete?
Question one and three tie together, so I'll try to answer it briefly. It is the most difficult thing to do is to make a documentary exciting. Most documentaries have improved, I think, quite a bit in recent years, but most tend to be boring or to go to a lot of talking head interviews where you're making the point, I think, sometimes repeatedly. I was very impressed with the British series World at War, 1970s, 2, 3, Jeremy Isaacs, 26 hours, although it's vastly, I think, unbalanced on the Soviet issue. I think it's a magnificent series that proved that you can make a long form 26 hours of one subject and keep an audience over time, not just in the present season, but over 30, 40, 50 years. I would like this series to be out there in the next 20 years and be able to come back and talk about it and see what was wrong in hindsight or what was right. This is a form of inquisition. So to make that inquisition exciting, in other words, I'm learning, you're, and hopefully some of the audience is learning, here's the key to this thing. And you make the music, you have movie clips where you need them, and you cut free associatively to images that you think might be apropos. Someone in the style of Adam Curtis, who's been much criticized for it, but so what? He broke barriers. He made us think in new terms. The book is available. You can read the book separately from the movie, and you will have it's a different experience. When you see a movie, you're in that movie for that moment, and I hope you saw a sense of it today, the drama, the build-up. We start out with a thesis, then there's a counterattack, and then often the synthesis. And we all do that in 58 minutes and 30 seconds to the second. The narration is the result of much rewriting. The narration has been simplified from extensive amount of subject matter. So I think, where is the line? You find the line every time. When people start to fall asleep watching it, that's your answer. When people are awake watching it and are provoked, that's your answer. So it's a very subjective thing, but I love exciting documentaries. But as long as, in this case, we were fact-checked to death, there's no question we lost a lot of time with changes and fact-checks. We had separate fact checks from Showtime, from CBS Legal, and ourselves. We had one from our group. As to the second question, which was about
how we divided the new world segment.
The New World Order. Just briefly, I would say that I associate that terminology with George Bush, the father, in the 1980s when he went into Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, which is even a bigger offense. And call this sort of the end of the Vietnam syndrome and the beginning of the New World Order. It has very negative associations to me, and I know that it unleashed 20 more years of unfettered capitalism, where the banks and the IMF tried to run the world alongside this New World Order, and it seems to have been a disaster, because worse things happened after the Soviet Empire fell than any time during the Soviet Empire, possibly with the possible exception of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Berlin Wall and the oppressions we saw, not only in the Eastern Europe, but the oppressions we saw in the Third World countries by the U.S. So what happened with the Arab world and the fundamentalism that we trained and encouraged in Afghanistan, the concept of sending American combat troops in large numbers to the Middle East has been a disaster. The blowback, it was apparent on 2001, and it was blowback. It wasn't because they hated us for our freedoms, and it wasn't a monumental battle between good and evil, as George Bush called it. It was because we had troops in Saudi Arabia, and we had an Israeli policy that really made them very upset. And a lot stems from those two issues, as well as other issues. So we don't hear, we don't listen, we don't react. New World Order, I don't think it worked. I think we're in trouble because of the currency crisis and the financial crisis, right? Very much so. And there are cycles that are speeding up. I don't see how the New World Order can last, nor should it, because this is actually a white hegemon.
Well, Oliver answered it pretty well, I think.
Hegemon, sorry.
Hegemon, but let me just add that the New World Order, the period since the end of the Cold War, has been a period of American domination in a way that never existed before. The United States was really the only superpower. We've been the policemen of the world. We've been dictating, throwing our weight around in ways that don't work anymore. So even Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense and head of the CIA, said if any president invades another country like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, he should have his head examined. Well, Douglas MacArthur had said that to Jack Kennedy back in the 1960s. We didn't learn the lesson then. Perhaps we're learning it now. Not only can we not afford it, you know how much money we wasted in this war on terror? According to Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, and Laura Bilmes, that the actual cost has already been $4 trillion when all the medical benefits are counted up. So $4 trillion. We could have done a lot of good in the world with $4 trillion. What have we accomplished in Iraq and Afghanistan? We've disrupted traditional societies. In 2010, we spent $100 billion on the military in Afghanistan, $2 billion on development. What's the life expectancy there? With something like 47 years. The literacy rate, 10-15%. I mean, this is a country that really needs development aid. What have we delivered instead? We've increased the corruption. We've increased the, we've disrupted society there. We go in blindly. We get warned beforehand what the consequences can be, and we ignore them. You've got presidents who invade these countries. George Bush didn't know the difference between the Sunnis and the Shiites. I mean, we're dealing with a level of ignorance. The China experts were driven out of the State Department during the McCarthy period. So, of course, we go into Vietnam. We know nothing about Vietnamese history. We didn't. Nobody spoke the language. We invade countries cavalierly. We don't even have the level of knowledge that the British had. At least the British had some knowledge of the countries that they were conquering and dominating. The Americans didn't even have that when we go into these places.
Peter, can I just ask you to pick up the question about choice of historical events? Because it does seem one of the sort of interesting tensions in the series is between this sort of systematic critique of the American security state, but also kind of portraits of people you might not have heard before, like Wallace.
Do people know?
They're all villains, so in a sense, there is this kind of dichotomy in it between kind of having kind of not really goodies and baddies, but there are villains of the piece and there are unsung heroes, and yet there is also this attempt to apply this sort of systematic view of America, and that is an interesting editorial.
Well, we started off with the idea that we were going to explain how the United States went so far wrong by 2008, and we wanted to challenge these fundamental assumptions that American kids just get in their schools, they get from television, this assumption about America's benighted sense of entitlement and this arrogant attitude. And so we looking for a pattern. We're trying to find the patterns that go on throughout. We started with 1890s. Why 1890s? Because in 1898, in the Spanish-American War, the United States goes through a transformation. Up to that point, the United States had been fairly sympathetic to revolution and reform around the world and progressive forces. In 1899, we invade the Philippines. We overthrow the Aguinaldo government, popular movement there. And the United States begins to make the shift from being the world's progressive force to being the world's leading counter-revolutionary force. We continue that in the interventions over and over again in Latin America. Then, after when the Cold War begins, or right after World War II, the Cold War was not inevitable. Roosevelt didn't think that there was going to be enmity between the United States and the Soviets. Roosevelt foresaw a period of friendship between the United States and the Soviet Union. Churchill was a little bit more dubious, of course, but Churchill was out of power during Potsdam by July 1945. Anthony Eden was furious. He gave an interview in 1946 with Robert Sherwood, in which he expressed his fury toward Churchill and Truman for creating this mess with the Soviet Union. And he said, had Roosevelt lived, that would not have happened. That's why we bring in Henry Wallace in such a prominent way. Do people know Henry Wallace? Is he a familiar figure? Because usually when we do this one, I give a little introduction beforehand to set up Henry Wallace, because if you had seen our first two episodes, you would know Henry Wallace. But Wallace was Roosevelt's vice president from 41 to 45. You saw his Century of the Common Man speech. And Henry Luce in 1941, the head of the Time Life Empire, says the 20th century must be the American century. The U.S. will dominate the world. Wallace responds, says the 20th century must be the century of the common man. He calls for a worldwide people's revolution. He was a visionary, and he was Roosevelt's vice president. And then there's what's called Pauley's coup, run by the treasurer of the Democratic Party, to throw Wallace off the ticket. They knew that Roosevelt was getting sick, that he would not last another term, that whoever was vice president would become the next president of the United States. And Wallace was enormously popular. The week the Democratic Party convention started, July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll asking potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. Wallace was the second most popular American at the time. So they engineered this coup with the party bosses to get him off the ticket. But in the midst of that, during the convention, Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, got 5 feet from the microphone to put Wallace's name in nomination before the bosses forced the adjournment. Had Pepper gotten those 5 more feet, we show, then Wallace would have been back on the ticket. He would have swept the convention that night. And we argue that there would have been no atomic bomb and very possibly no Cold War. If it was one, it would have taken a very, very different form than it did. So we're trying to find those moments where history twists, where those hinges, where the doors of history turn, and where things could have been different. And that was one of those key moments in 1944 and 1945. But we point to a lot of other ones as well, because we want to give people a sense of hope also. The stuff is very bleak about the atomic bombing, the Cold War, the wars that we're pointing out. But we also know that things are hopeful, that there are social movements, social forces that also push history in certain directions. And there are also visionary leaders. And the United States has had some who've tried to take our country in different directions. They haven't unfortunately succeeded, and some of them have been changed. But change is possible, and different directions are possible.
I think we should take some more questions. If we perhaps take the gentleman at the back, and then if you come down to the well, we'll take three again.